From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's On Point, and this is Kristen Burton. She lives in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
My husband and my combined income for last year was under $70,000. We are in full-time ministry. And our federal income tax alone was almost $12,000.
So $12,000 out of $70,000, a quick back-of-the-envelope calculation puts Kristen's effective overall federal tax rate at about 17%. But then Kristen read the New York Times' recent blockbuster investigation on what President Trump has paid in taxes across a bunch of years. That was very close to 0%.
That's amazing to me that people that make $200,000, $300,000 and more, that they don't pay taxes or they pay very little. My husband and I have been working for 45 plus years of our lives. We've chosen the work that we do, and we're blessed. We do ministry, full-time ministry. But that, over $11,000 just in federal taxes for one annual income is pretty crazy.
Pretty crazy. But that pretty crazy is inside the federal tax code. So today we're going to be talking about what the New York Times investigation of President Trump's taxes reveals, actually about what we all pay. So joining us to help us do that is Adam Davidson. He's with us from Charlotte, Vermont. He's a contributing writer for The New Yorker, where he writes about business and the economy. He's been reporting for years on Trump's finances. He's also host of the podcast The Passion Economy, author of a book by the same name. And of course, he is co-founder of Planet Money. Adam, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Meghna. So great to be here.
Okay, so there's a lot to dig into because the Times investigation, thousands of documents, many thousands of words here. What are your big takeaways about how much the president has paid in taxes?
Well, I think one thing that you pointed out in the intro that should not be overlooked is that our tax system is far more wildly pro-rich than I think most people have taken in. I think when we talk about taxes, we talk about marginal tax rates. So, rich people might have a marginal tax rate much higher than poor people, and there's a lot of discussion about that. But the far more disturbing thing is the ability of wealthier people to use corporate tax instead of individual tax to essentially avoid paying almost any tax. And that is a true issue that we as a nation truly need to address. That being said, it's a few weeks before a presidential election, so we probably should put that to one side for 5 minutes and focus on the president of the United States and what this tells us about him personally. And I think a few things scream at me through the Times reporting, both this recent tax story and the very, in my mind, even more explosive tax story of last year that they did, which really shows that from the beginning, from Fred Trump, well, it actually began with Fred's mother, but Fred Trump, certainly in the 60s, 70s, 80s, into the 2000s, when he died, did two things. He built real value. He really did come up with ideas for buildings that would house sort of lower middle class people in Brooklyn and Queens. And he seemed to do a decent job of that and actually create housing that generated revenue.
Along with some Justice Department investigations about
yes,
racism.
I mean, hugely problematic. Yes, absolutely. I'm not here to celebrate Fred Trump. He's, by all accounts, a truly horrible, horrible human being. My whole point is just there was value creation in at least financial terms. Yes, absolutely. Racist policies, outrageous policies, corruption, but real businesses in the sense that they made more money than they cost.
Right.
And a massive tax fraud. So he was doing both things. And that Donald, it seems hard to point to many examples where he himself came up with a business, other than a small handful, Trump Tower, it turns out, and then some deals he was sort of pushed into that he didn't want to be into, like the Vornado deal, that for the most part, Donald Trump created businesses that did not exist, work as actual profit businesses, but maintain the tax fraud elements. And that really at the core of the Trump wealth is, I mean, there's been a lot of discussion. Is he broke? Is he a good businessman? I would say, and Dan Alexander and I think slightly disagree on this, but I would say he's broke in the sense that he has not found a way to generate enough income to support the lifestyle and business that he wants. But he definitely has a lot more money than I do, and most people do. But that fundamentally at the core of the Trump organization is manipulating, taking, a lawyer might say, taking extremely high risk games or strategies with the tax code and other financial and other regulations to profit, not from actually creating businesses that work, but from evading the consequences of creating businesses that don't work.
Yeah.
In other words, the man we saw in the debates yesterday is the man who ran these businesses, an impulsive, angry, out of control person who was really, really lucky to be born to a very rich father.
Yeah. So let's talk about a couple of things that the Times is reporting as the president actually having done. I mean, you referenced their story from last year, which is the one where they revealed that, or they discovered that he had claimed, what, $1 billion in losses, that he may have been of any American filing taxes, he may have claimed more losses than any other person in this country. And those losses carried forward over several years. Is that the story? I'm trying to keep all of them straight in my head.
That is a big part of that story. Okay. Although another part of that story was they really spelled out the many kind of audacious schemes that Fred Trump set up to avoid paying taxes.
I see.
So
okay.
So creating fake companies that were, you know, fake doing business for the Trump organization, that were shell companies that allowed them to send payments to a shell company, wildly inflated payments to a shell company so that they could deduct those payments. But the shell company wasn't really providing boilers and drywall and stuff. Or if it was, it was at a fraction of the amount of the payment.
Yeah.
So it was a, I mean, it really is a masterclass in how to evade taxes by either illegally or certainly unethically and highly risky.
So here in the Times news stories, then, to sort of, it feels a little wrong to try and sum up this much reporting in a nutshell, but it seems that one of the conclusions is that even as the president, for example, in the years following his windfall from The Apprentice, right? I mean, there's some more than $400 million in income at one point in time, that due to a combination of things such as the depreciation he could take from his real estate, some very interesting write-offs, some business expenses, claims of having walked away from others, that this whole combination of claims has led him to be able to pay $0 in some years, or, you know, the number they start off the story with, $750 in 2017. $750, that's it, out of all of the money that's flowed through the Trump organization, only $750 went to paying taxes on the president's behalf. So, I mean, what is this a picture of? Is this a picture of someone who has a great team of CPAs and is just exploiting what's in the tax code, or is there something else going on here?
This is not savvy. That is one thing I want to dispel right away.
Okay.
This is not sophisticated. This is not like, you know, there are lots of accounting firms, probably all of the big accounting firms, that can achieve outcomes like this using all sorts of sophisticated tools where you really have, you know, really brilliant people who have decided to spend their career helping rich people evade taxes. This is, I mean, picture Trump's offices in Trump Tower, and maybe read my colleague at the New Yorker, Patrick Radin Keefe's wonderful profile of Mark Burnett and how they show up 2003, 2004. It's this shabby, dingy office. They have to build a set to show Trump as a prominent businessman because his actual offices are just so shabby. And there's this character, Alan Weisselberg, went to Pace University in New York, got a job with Fred Trump in 1970, was transferred to Donald in 1973, and has just been sitting in this dingy office handling Trump's finances ever since. And the best picture we get, Alan Weisselberg describes the operation in the New York State Attorney General's lawsuit against the Trump Foundation. And Weisselberg is pretty blunt. I mean, this is a shabby, sad little thing. It's Alan Weisselberg, by all accounts, a pretty unpleasant man who holds probably – he probably knows more about Trump's finances than Trump does. And a couple assistants just making up stuff or, you know, I mean, in the Trump Foundation case, they're sort of very casually deciding – what do we consider charitable? What do we consider not charitable? There's no rigor. This is not sophisticated. This is crude, crude, crude. And when you look at this small team of people and you carry them forward from 1973 to 1980s, when, you know, Trump's expanding, you know, into Manhattan, to the 1990s, getting into casinos, getting into airlines, to 2000s, he's becoming a global marketing brand. It's this same small team of people. Then we get some new folks like Michael Cohen, the kids Ivanka and Don Jr., and eventually Eric show up. But it's really the same group of people. And these are not airline executives. These are not casino geniuses. These are, you know, local outer borough folks who know a few things and keep doing a few things, which is taking wild risks and outrageous stuff on taxes.
So we're going to talk more about that when we come back. We are taking a look at what's revealed by the New York Times investigation about President Trump's taxes and really what it says more broadly about how taxes affect us all. Let's head into the break with a little bit of Gene Autry singing I Paid My Income Tax Today. This is On Point.
I paid my income tax today.
We paid our income tax today. We never cared what Congress spent, but now we watch your every cent, examine every bill they pay.
They'll have to let us have our say. I wrote the Treasury to go slow. Careful, Mr. Henry Jr., that's my dough.
I paid my income tax today.
Yes,
support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about the New York Times investigation into President Trump's taxes and how much he actually paid in taxes. And really, the deeper question is, what does it mean for all of us, for the rest of America? What does it reveal about the federal tax code? I'm joined today by Adam Davidson. He's a contributing writer for The New Yorker, co-founder of NPR's Planet Money, and host of the podcast The Passion Economy, and author of a book by the same name. Well, let's also bring in now Dan Alexander. He's senior editor at Forbes covering Donald Trump's businesses and author of the new book, White House Inc., How Donald Trump Turned the Presidency into a Business. Dan, welcome to you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, I actually just want to start by playing a little bit of this week's presidential debate, because this issue of taxes and how much the president has paid did come up. Chris Wallace asked the president about the Times reporting, and here is part of President Trump's reply.
Chris, let me just say something, that it was the tax laws. I don't want to pay tax. Before I came here, I was a private developer. I was a private business people. Like every other private person, unless they're stupid, they go through the laws, and that's what it is. He passed a tax bill that gave us all these privileges for depreciation and for tax credits. We build a building and we get tax credits, like the hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue. You get a massive, which, by the way, was given to me by the Obama administration, if you can believe that.
President Trump just this week Dan Alexander, first of all, there's so much in that little clip. That hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue. What do you think?
Well, of course, he's referring to the Trump International Hotel here, and which, in fact, the Obama administration did grant him the lease on. But, you know, he might be regretting having gotten that lease. That business is not in good shape. About the only one who seems to be doing very well in that business is actually the federal government, which receives regular lease payments from the Trump Organization. But those lease payments are high enough and the business is small enough that Trump doesn't seem to be making any money there, not just on a tax basis, but even on an operating business, it's really struggling. And then if you look at the tax numbers, you know, the New York Times reports that from 2016 when it opened to the end of 2018, the Trump Organization declared $55.5 million of tax losses on that one property.
So is one of the lessons here that it's not so much manipulation of tools available in the tax code, but actually Adam was saying this a little earlier, that these businesses just aren't being run well. They are taking major losses.
So certain businesses are definitely in trouble. The Trump International Hotel is an example of that. Trump National Doral, his golf resort down in Miami, is another example of that. But if you look across the empire, and if you particularly focus on his commercial real estate properties, so 1290 Avenue of the Americas in New York City, 555 California Street in San Francisco, and then even Trump Tower and 40 Wall Street in New York and others as well, those buildings actually do throw off very large operating profits. And part of what the Times did that was so amazing is show how you can turn an empire that, and as Adam alluded to, we might disagree a little bit on this, but that is quite valuable and does throw off an enormous amount of operating profit, and make it look to the IRS like it's turning no profit or huge losses year after year after year, and therefore not have to pay much in taxes.
Adam, do you want to jump in here?
Sure. And, you know, I really do think Dan has done just such vital work. And I certainly like don't want to turn this into a conflict, but but we have arm wrestled and I've always beat him, Dan. I think you'd admit that's true. But I do think there's no question that there is a business that Trump could have been a very rich man with a huge amount of cash flow and led an unbelievably comfortable life. And I think tellingly, most of those office deals were not things Trump pursued. 44 Wall Street, he was sort of forced into it by one of the lawyers on his staff, sort of snuck it into his holdings. For the Vornado deal, he sued to get out of. So I think, you know, there's sort of a there is, you know, it turns out being born to a very rich father who's willing to lavish you with money and then having a team of lawyers who occasionally get you into good deals is, it's a good thing to have in your life. Like those are, yes, there was a path for him to be an unquestionably very rich, very comfortable person. I think there are some projects like Trump Tower where you can say, okay, Donald Trump had an idea, put capital at risk, and that idea paid off. But the vast majority of decisions he's made as a business person are failures. And I'd say his appetite. So, you know, if you make 10,000 and, you know, I know Amish people, I happen to have a bunch of Amish friends, they make, you know, $20,000 a year, and they have everything they want, and you would not call them broke. And obviously, there can be very, very rich people who don't make enough to support their vision of the life they want. And so in that context, I would say the Trump story throughout has been, he's born on third base, or he's born, you know, having gotten a Grand Slam home run, and his appetites far outweigh what he's been given, and his ability to get more has been proven again and again to be, he's not very good at that.
So let me just take a step back with both of you. I'm going to ask a series of rudimentary questions because, I mean, look, taxes are complicated. Because most of us don't have billion-dollar businesses. So, I mean, we're talking here about the president's personal income taxes, right? Taxes on his personal income. So just to make one thing clear, I mean, this isn't like a sort of an independent, separate corporate entity that's paying its own taxes. Somehow that money is coming back to the president. There's no divide between the president and his business, Dan. I just wanted to lay that out. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, that's totally fair. And I think that it's one of the things that people have, you know, misunderstood about Trump's business from the start. You know, this isn't a large corporation that, you know, where Trump is, you know, has to appease other shareholders or other stakeholders. This is a one-man shop. He still owns the company. Most of the entities through which he holds these properties are pass-through entities. So really, it's just, they're just shell companies. He amazingly has not given away significant stakes in any of these businesses to his children, which is a separate tax story that might end up really biting them with a large estate tax at some point. But he still owns 100% of the entities that he did at the time that he took office. Interestingly, one of the only exceptions to that is the DC Hotel, where each of the kids has a 7.5% stake and he owns the rest. But yes, the Trump Organization is him. He is the Trump Organization. The idea that there's separation just doesn't make any sense and isn't what happens in reality.
Okay, so then in a well-run business, in that case, if the business is profitable, that profit goes to the business person. But at the same time, then, that person owns the liabilities, too. They are personally on the hook for what they own. Or what they owe, I should say. And that's also a part of this story, that perhaps there are some major bills that are going to come due for the president himself as an individual. Is that right, Adam?
Yeah. And one thing I do want to reiterate is part of this is just how being rich in America works. Mm-hmm. So if you can think of anyone rich, and I don't even mean billionaire, I mean, you know, people who make several hundred thousand dollars a year, there's a very good chance that they have created a bunch of companies that, and then they are one, you know, it's not hard. You know, a lot of journalists who do freelance work have a company. It's a very trivial thing to do. And then once you have companies, you are allowed to, there are things you can do that allow you to decide what becomes, income and what doesn't. Now, that doesn't mean it's infinite and anyone can pay no taxes, obviously. There's constraints and there's best practices and et cetera, et cetera. But part of what Trump is doing is just how it is to be rich in America. It's why we keep hearing about income inequality in our tax system. It's more this than the marginal tax rates, I would probably argue. But in addition to that, I do want to say the point of having it is better to have a business that makes profit and then is taxed than to have a business that is losing money that you then don't have to pay taxes on. I mean, it is most rich people don't want to pay $750 in taxes because they want to make enough money. It's not that they want to pay taxes, but they want to be profitable. They want to have more, they want to put their capital at risk and then make profit. And part of a side effect is there is a limit. So it turns out if you don't want to pay taxes, having some really successful businesses and some wildly colossal failures is a great way not to pay taxes, but it's not a great way to be a business person or to increase your wealth or it's not a good model. So there's stuff he's doing that's just bog standard for rich people in America. And there's stuff he's doing that's like, oh, he's just kind of crazy and bad at being a rich person and a businessman.
Well, so Dan, let me turn back to you because this model, as Adam puts it, this model is what's being followed by the president of the United States, right? He never divested himself at all in any meaningful way, that big press conference with that stack of papers aside, from these businesses, and he's the president of the United States. I mean, so we've never had a moment like this where a purported billion-dollar businessman was the person in the White House.
Well, that's right. And one of the clearest examples of what Adam is talking about is if you look at Trump National Doral, the golf resort in Miami. You know, so Trump buys the thing for $150 million, and then he invests $213 million into fixing it up. So now we're at $363 million. We currently value that property without counting its debt, at $153 million. So that means that Trump is $210 million in the hole there. Now, sure, he can take off a lot of depreciation against all of that money that he's plowed into the business. But from a business perspective, it would be much, much better to have that $210 million and not have poured it down the drain. But now that he does, to your point, you know, he's in a situation where he has some businesses that are in real trouble that can connect with his presidency, and his presidency might be able to help. So, for example, you know, he pushed the G7 toward Doral to try to get that big, you know, worldwide famous event to Doral. Now, remember, Doral has lost other major golf tournaments and that sort of stuff since he entered politics. And so if you bring in all of those people, not only is that additional revenue, but it's also additional marketing. I mean, it makes the thing world famous, even though ultimately he had to pull back and not do it because it was such an embarrassment and so many Republicans couldn't stomach it and said, you know, you really have to double back on this and not do it at Doral. And then, of course, ultimately the coronavirus turned over everything that was supposed to be the G7. But the idea that he was pushing that business to Doral, which itself is a struggling property because of investment decisions that don't make any sense, that's sort of the place that we're in right now with this business, this multi-billion dollar business that Trump has lugged into the Oval Office with him.
So, Adam, what Dan is describing there has another word to it, right? Corruption. Potential corruption.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I mean, to me, that obviously there's zero question that he's using the presidency to enrich himself. I think part of what is shocking is how like low rent it is. It's, you know, he has shown this throughout his career, as the Times shows, you know, a willingness to debase his brand, to take on wild financial risks and legal risks for a few hundred thousand dollars or a million here or 2 million there. So, it does seem that the Dan, I believe you put his cash flow in any year, like the money he has access to, the liquid cash at around 160 million, if I'm correct, 159. And the Times has it quite a bit lower, although by definition, your taxes are trying to hide how much money you have. But let's say it's somewhere in $150 million that he has access to. That's before he's, you know, paying for food and fuel for his planes and all that stuff. He doesn't act like a man who has access to $160 million. He acts like a man who very regularly is absolutely desperate for a few hundred grand or a million or 2 million. And I think that is part of the fundamental mystery of this guy, which is and part of why I have a discomfort with just accepting that he is truly, in the fullest sense of the word, a billionaire who has access to $160 million a year, because he doesn't behave like someone who does. The other piece of this, I should say, so this is kind of small scale corruption, getting the Secret Service to overpay for their stay, that kind of thing, and you know, getting Mike Pence to stay in a resort miles away from, I mean, you know, hours away from Dublin when he goes to Ireland, that kind of thing. But then there, to me, the biggest mystery, and it's a mystery, but it is a mystery, is Trump's a guy who spent other people's money. He spent his dad's windfall. He spent the apprentice windfall. But his biggest spending, where he claims it's his own money, starts in 2011. And as the Times shows, his biggest debts start in 2011. Mm-hmm. And it is hard. The Times says, well, maybe he saved his apprentice money and then spent it. It seems not in keeping with someone who has these like liquidity crises where he doesn't have enough cash. It's also 2011 is really when his international relationships with truly sketchy people, the Mamadovs, the Agalarovs, Harry Tenasebjo, these are known corrupt money laundering oligarchs in other countries. It's right when he's developing business relationships with them. So to me, it is, we don't know, but there's circumstantial suggestion that right when he's getting a new inflow of cash, of either debt financed property or money to spend is right when he's meeting these people who are desperate to launder money into the U.S., some of them specifically through golf courses. So to me, the big question is it just this kind of sad little corruption, or is there something even bigger going on?
Yeah. Well, Dan, we've just got you for another 40 seconds or so. I just wonder if you wanted to respond to Adam there.
Well, I think that those are, you know, legitimate questions and ones that obviously we should all continue to be looking into. On the sort of small scale corruption thing, you know, one pathetic part of this story is that if Trump had just sold everything like the ethics experts told him to at the start and invested it all back in the S&P 500, you know, the numbers change week to week based on what the market's doing. The last time that I counted, it would mean that he would be $800 million richer today than having held on to this pile of assets that he still owns.
The very market he's been talking up for years. The very same stock market. Well, Dan Alexander, senior editor at Forbes and author of White House Inc., thank you so much for joining us today, Dan.
Thank you.
Adam, hang on here for a second. We'll pick this up when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about what's revealed about the president's taxes in the New York Times big investigative pieces that they've been publishing over the past many days. And the deeper question of what it means actually for all of us, for the nation, that people who can make so much money can also claim so little in federal taxes. Adam Davidson joins us. He's a contributing writer at The New Yorker, where he covers business and economics, co-founder of Planet Money on NPR, and host of the podcast The Passion Economy. So joining us now as well from Atlanta is Dorothy Brown. She's a professor at Emory University School of Law and author of the forthcoming book, The Whiteness of Wealth, How the Tax System Impoverishes Black Americans and How We Can Fix It. Professor Brown, welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, you know, I actually want to talk more big picture with you for a few minutes here, because a little earlier in the show, I played that clip from the president and the debate earlier this week. And he said, hey, there's a tax bill. It allows for privileges, for depreciation, for tax credits, for all the sort of gravy that goes into real estate investments, essentially. So, I mean, is what we're talking about here just fundamentals that are baked into the tax code?
So the easy answer is yes. And the problem is the wealthy are the ones who can afford an army of tax lawyers to figure out the loopholes in the Internal Revenue Code and use them for their clients' advantage.
And so is that the difference, that you can buy the expertise to navigate the complete labyrinth that is the tax code? Because there are many smaller business people in the United States, you know, they might own some residential real estate, that some of these same rules apply to them, right? The depreciation,
right,
being able to carry forward losses, tax credits, et cetera. And in fact, those are the very rules that help them as small business people continue forward for hopefully the longer term payoff of managing real estate. So what's the difference here? It's the same set of rules, right?
Well, so it's a little more complicated than that.
Okay.
When I read the New York Times reporting, I saw a couple of things. One is the president taking tax deductions for what really, in my opinion, are personal living expenses that are not deductible. In fact, if students in my class were to write on an exam that fact pattern would result in a trade or business deduction, they'd get an F. It's just not even close.
Wow.
So with him, you have him flouting the law, in my view, as opposed to taking advantage of the law.
Okay.
So there's tax avoidance versus, you know, tax fraud.
So can you give us a nuts and bolts example? So say about this world of claiming losses, right? So
right.
It's like if I went underwater in my mortgage and I had to sell my home at a loss,
yes.
Could I claim that?
No deduction for you. But if you sell your stock at a loss, you get a deduction. Why? Because Congress decided in its infinite wisdom that if you have a trade or business, you can get a loss. If you hold investment property like stock, you can get a loss. But your personal property, no loss for you unless it's in connection with a federally declared disaster. Like think of the floods or the wildfires in California. So the problem is personal, you know, individuals cannot take a loss for a bad year they have. He is taking a loss. The president is taking a loss because he's a partner in any number of partnerships, and the items, the partnership losses are flowing through to his personal tax return.
Okay. But look, I'm going to play the devil's advocate here because
we got
to this point for a reason, right? I mean, businesses are not profitable every year,
yes.
Right? And so that's part of this, that if we're going to continue to tax businesses for a particular bad year they had, that puts them at a long-term disadvantage. So there's some reason behind this.
Oh, there's absolute logic behind it, but there's also some unfairness, right? Why is it if I sell my home in the middle of a recession – I can't take that loss, but if I sell my stock, I can, right? So that's not fair, but that's what the law says. So yeah, there's logic behind it, but there also would be logic behind allowing a loss deduction on selling my personal residence, but we don't have that.
Right. So Adam, do you want to jump in here about
Yeah, I mean, I want to really endorse what Professor Brown is saying. So if we were going to just create, and this is something actually tax professors do, you create, you know, sort of model economies where you're trying to design the tax system to create the most growth. And then there's a sort of discussion about, do you also want it to be equitable growth? But there is no model, no theoretical model that ends up with the system we have where where corporate real estate is treated completely different, as Professor Brown said, from personal real estate, where tax investments are treated totally different from other types of investments. So in theory, if we wanted to create a great capitalist economy, what we would want is whatever system gets capital, money, to the best ideas and the most forward-looking ideas so that we have constant growth. That's the theory. That is the theory behind tax efficiency. What we have, and this is, and I am very much looking forward to Professor Brown's book, rooted in the racist origins of our country and the fight between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson and slaveholders and non-slaveholders. But we preference land and real estate. We preference existing holders of capital over potential future holders of capital. And it is a millstone around the neck of the U.S. economy. Trump is such a great example of this because, as we said in the first segment, this is a man who inherited unimaginable wealth and squandered it crazily. I mean, you should look at his businesses like some kid driving a Ferrari into a brick wall, jumping out, grabbing another Ferrari, driving it into a brick wall. And it is our tax system that has allowed this to continue, that has encouraged this to continue. So yes, Trump is an outlier. He is the worst of this. But it is also fundamentally built into the way America practices capitalism. And it is racist, absolutely, explicitly designed to be, but it is also just what we want is an economy where smart people with new ideas are able to get money, put it at risk, and benefit when those risks pay off and lose when those risks don't. We have a system that is better at giving existing holders of wealth buffers from the consequences of their bad decisions and makes it extremely hard for people who don't happen to have capital to take those risks. And that's a terrible system for all of us.
So, yeah, we've just got a couple of minutes left here, and I think that's where I want to land this conversation. And Professor Brown, so when you saw all this reporting from the New York Times, the big question is, okay, so what does this actually mean for every other American? What is being revealed here about, as Adam was saying, how the tax code applies in his life, in your life, in my life, in all the lives of people listening here? What's being revealed?
How unfair it is and how we need serious tax reform. You know, picking up on what Adam said, the tax code right now is very unfair to labor. So we have this tax rate on labor wages, which most Americans earn, right, up to 37%. But the tax rate on capital, mm-hmm. income from stock, is at most 23.8%. 37, 23.8. Why? Right? Because we have an unfair tax system that allows the wealth of the Fred Trumps of the world. By the way, let me just say, if Fred Trump was black, he would have no wealth, because Fred Trump was getting government insured loans that were excluding black people. Mm-hmm. So if Fred Trump is not black, Donald Trump doesn't exist.
So there's fundamental unfairnesses there. And you're talking about the difference between taxation on capital versus labor. Those were decisions that were made by the whole system was made by people, right? These are decisions that are made in Congress, right? Like, like the capital gains rate got cut in 2000, right? So this can actually be undone. We can build a fairer system.
We can fix it. So for example, we can go back to the Reagan Tax Reform Act of 86, which required capital to be taxed at the same rate as labor. So yeah, in the not too distant past, we have an example where we got it right. And then, you know, the rest went down quickly.
So where would you start then, though, Professor Brown? Go ahead. Yeah,
I would start there. I would start with the fundamental idea that's embedded into the code that capital is to be preferred to labor. And that's just wrong. So I would start with repealing the preferential rate for capital gains.
And what about the...
And if I could just quickly add...
Sure,
sorry,
Adam, go ahead.
And then I totally agree with that. But then also within capital, real estate and debt financing are preferred, rewarded irresponsibly over other uses of capital. So it's
absolutely
doubly biased.
Yeah. I'm Team Adam.
Adam, just in 30 seconds, can you explain a little bit more about how you see it's doubly biased?
So, by the way, this is not Republican, Democrat, left wing, right wing. You get a group of far right wing tax efficiency experts, they're going to agree with me. I consider myself on the left, but this is pretty straightforward technical stuff. But basically, what you want is a tax system that every American wakes up in the morning and is able to do the thing that they think is the best use of their either labor or their money, and the tax system is not rewarding some of them and hurting others irresponsibly, because that eventually sends signals throughout the economy that forces the economy in the wrong direction. That's what we have. That's what we have to get rid of.
Wow. Well, you know, we just got started on this, and I want to come back to it again and again and again, because I'm fascinated by what taxes say about what kind of society we want to have. So Adam Davidson, contributing writer for The New Yorker, co-founder of Planet Money. Thank you so much, Adam.
Thank you so much.
And Dorothy Brown, professor of Emory University School of Law and author of the forthcoming The Whiteness of Wealth, How the Tax System Impoverishes Black Americans and How We Can Fix It. Professor Brown, come back sometime, will you?
I'd love to.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. In the last few minutes that we have together today, I want to take a moment to announce some changes that are coming to On Point. This is the last week that On Point will be a two-hour talk show. Because starting next week, we're evolving. We're moving towards a new one-hour can't-miss show. So technically, yes, there will be technically fewer minutes of On Point for those of you who listen for 2 hours a day. But we've chosen to do this so that we can serve you better, actually, to deeply focus and concentrate our efforts, those same resources, to bring you more in each minute of the program. And we thought this was especially important to do in the year 2020, because we realize that listeners don't necessarily need more programming, more airtime, more headlines, but rather what we all need is more clarity and more engagement and better journalism. So this is how we're going to strive to do that. So in order to talk a little bit more about this major change to the program, I want to bring in Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, who has been with this program since its inception in September of 2001. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay, so just to remind folks, and we have some very long-term listeners to this program, there was a world-changing event in September 2001, and On Point was created to meet the needs of that time. I mean, the terrorist attacks of 9/11 really shook this country. And now, in 2020, we realize that there are big world-changing events happening now. We need to take that fundamental DNA of the show about meeting listeners where they are and serving their needs and evolve that approach for now. But I just wanted to ask you, how do you feel about that, having been with, you know, On Point for so many years and so many years to come, Jack?
Well, if I may, let me just mention our birth. You know, present at the creation of the show were Graham Griffith. He's the visionary who invented the program over a weekend. He had help from a BBC veteran, the late Ian Doherty, and another witty Caledonian, James Ross, then and now our chief engineer, as well as the indefatigable Eileen Imada. As senior managing producer, she continues doing everything to put the show on the air. The first host of On Point was my friend, the intellectually omnivorous Tom Ashbrook. Tom made the show a forum for a national conversation for a country in crisis. Karen Schiffman was for years our executive producer. Karen's dedication, leadership, above all, integrity, set the bar high for On Point, where it remains. Since 2001, as you say, when I came aboard, it's been my luck to work with such gifted colleagues as them and you, Meghna, about your luminous qualities, to quote the Irishman, exhausted of superlatives, I could go on like the brook forever.
Well, don't, because I want to talk about what's to come, Jack. And although I do appreciate you going through the history of this show a little bit, because I want to emphasize, I mean, I was a producer at On Point for the first 5 years of my journalistic career, and it's very deep in the legacy and DNA of this show to serve listeners with the best journalism that meets the urgent need of their day. That has been with the show from the start, and it will continue to be a driving force of the program as we move to this 1 hour format. And so we just thought, like, there's so much complexity right now that we wanted to take the same resources we have and be able to deliver audio and narrative rich journalism and marry that with live conversation. Hear from you, Jack. I want to emphasize to people, Jack Beatty will still be with us both on air and off air as our deeply wise advisor. And to move forward to sort of make sense of the complexity that we're all living with now. And we're going to try and do that within a 1 hour format, Jack. So let's give it our best shot.
Amen. I'm looking forward to it, Meghna.
Okay. So On Point as a 1 hour program starting next week. And I'm supposing that a lot of long-term listeners might have some thoughts about this. So go to onpointradio.org to send us an email. We're going to read them all. Hop over to Twitter. I'm at Meghna, WBUR, or you can go to On Point Radio and send us your thoughts. But we will be here for you in a deep new way, and we hope you stick with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.